Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
And welcome to a brand new episode of Happy Mum, Happy Baby, the podcast. Today's guest is a journalist, writer, trans man who carried and birthed his two children. It's Freddie McConnell. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Today's a very big day and I'm honoured that you're here in the studio with me because your eldest has started school.
Yeah, today was the first morning. It's just a morning and then we've got a kind of settling in week.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a huge day. Luckily, he totally took it in his stride. I wasn't sure when we woke up this morning. He's quite inscrutable sometimes. I wasn't sure how it would go. When we woke up, he said, "I want to stay with you," which was definitely just his way of saying, "I don't want to go to school." But yeah, we just kind of got ready, kept moving in a forward momentum, you know, validating what he's saying, but, you know, it's going to be fine. And luckily he's going to school with a few of his mates, so that's definitely helpful.
And how did you feel when when he walked through the door?
I think I was in the moment just very relieved that it had gone so well and a bit like, oh, wow, I'm just going to, I'll just creep away. And then we went for coffee, me and some friends afterwards to sort of debrief. But in general, I'm not great at sort of processing things as they're happening in the moment. So I knew in the lead up to SJ going to school that I probably wasn't going to really feel it, whereas all my friends seemed to have been talking about it a lot. And, you know, sort of when they finish nursery or these big milestones throughout the year, kind of like, oh God, it's so hard. And all like when the uniform arrives, it's very emotional. And I just didn't really feel any of that. And actually it was last night when the idea that, oh, this is really happening and it's the end of his infancy, it's the end of... Yeah, so that's what got me, was the idea that it was the end of his total freedom for us to, for him to do what he's always done his whole life and for us to hang out. I don't know. I mean, still, I'm not the best at processing my own feelings and emotions.
But do you think part of that is because you write? So maybe when you sit down, that's when you kind of digest a little bit more.
I mean, I do struggle with the writing side of it as well. I mean, if anyone, you know, I've made this documentary about being pregnant with SJ and giving birth. And the thing I found hardest about that was Jeannie, the filmmaker, would interview me a lot. We spent a lot of time together, obviously. And it was often just the two of us, Jeannie behind the camera and also sort of talking to me. And I just began to dread her asking, how are you feeling?
Right.
I was just like, I don't know. I can't explain. Stop asking me, please. And then, like, writing about it, I actually kind of find equally hard, to be honest.
Yeah. I've watched Seahorse, your documentary, and I absolutely loved it. I always find with things like that, what's fascinating to me is the catalyst. Like, what made you start filming it to start with? Is it your journalistic side that led you there?
Yeah, definitely. I am, surprisingly, I am a very private person, and I'm also very introverted and socially
awkward.
She's
fascinating because it's like literally you're captured at your most vulnerable and it's compelling to watch.
I mean, I think that's probably why I knew I needed to get someone else to actually make it. So like Jeannie Finley, you know, I was lucky in that I was in a privileged position as a journalist at the time working at The Guardian, where I could go to our head of documentaries, Charlie Phillips, who's a good friend of mine to this day, and say to him, who do you know? Because he used to run Sheffield Docfest. So I did feel like I'm in a position where I could make this happen and it could be quite a big thing and it could be beautiful and seen by lots of people. So if I feel able to do that, I should. But yeah, so Jeannie, I sort of put a lot of power in her hands. I trusted her a lot. And absolutely, you know, obviously it paid off. I love the film. I'm very proud of what we did together. But yeah, I mean, I was quite lonely during that first pregnancy. There was nothing like the community online that there is now. Yeah. And this was just like 5 years ago, so that's kind of wild to think about as well, how much things have changed in such a short period of time. But I wasn't publicly on Instagram. Only a few people in my life knew what was happening. So yeah, it got harder and stuff. But, you know, and at the same time, because Jeannie and I had this close relationship, I was really worried about the birth scene. Like, that's at the end of the film, which I think actually is the most incredible thing in the film. Yep. I'm so glad I didn't pull out of that, but mm-hmm. I wanted to, a part of me wanted to. So I set these really strict ground rules for how it was to be filmed. And at the time, and I remember I took my glasses off when I was in the midwifery led unit in the pool. So the only person from the filmmaking crew that was in the room was Jeannie, and she was far enough away. I said, you have to stay at least 6 feet away from me at all times, which sounds like I must have been such a diva. But, you know, I just knew what my limit was. And I couldn't actually see her. It was so right. dark in that room. I didn't have my glasses on. So it was all just blurry. So she might as well not have been there, which was absolutely perfect. She yeah. respected my ground rules 100% without question. So like that made all the difference.
Like you say, it's a really powerful mm. moment within the film, because also within the, you know, the contractions and everything, mm. it's the peace mm. and the stillness that comes between them that you just forget about. No one talks about those yeah. moments that come between.
Oh man, I was so lucky. SJ's birth was just exactly what I wanted. And this is going to sound like a humble brag, which I suppose it is in a way, but, you know, to the point where I was so in the zone, not to say I wasn't in pain and uncomfortable, but I was in the zone, I suppose, in another place mentally, that I forgot that like pain relief existed. Mm. I didn't go into it thinking I don't want any pain relief. I just literally forgot about it. And so I got to the end and was like, oh yeah, I didn't even try gas and air. And then I was a bit disappointed that I hadn't tried gas and air. Like, oh God, that would have probably been quite nice. But yeah, it was just, oh, I was so lucky. You know, it was pre-COVID, so yeah. MLU was open. Everything was there that I needed.
Yeah. Let's go right back to your childhood. Where did you grow up mm-hmm. and what was childhood like? Did you have siblings?
Yeah, I've got a younger sister who's 2 years younger than me, and then a younger brother came along when I was 11.
Right.
Yeah. A half gap. Brother.
Yeah.
Yeah. I grew up in, well, I was born in London, and then we moved back down to where my dad's family is from in Southeast Kent. And I sort of grew up in Deal a little bit, but mostly Sandwich, which is the next town up the coast. Yeah. And it's funny because Deal, where we live now, which is about 3 miles away, is a very uniquely sort of diverse town in terms of LGBTQ people. It's quite a queer history. It was a right. smuggling town, lots of sex workers, lots of queer people, lots of transient populations. So it's always been quite a welcoming place. The motto of Deal is befriend the stranger, which I love.
That's nice.
Sandwich is quite a lot smaller and a lot more conservative
right.
and sedate. So that was not a fun place to grow up, you know, like hanging out outside the public toilets because there's literally nothing else to do. Kind mm-hmm. of thing. And I was a super awkward, shy, confused little kid. So I just didn't have the best time of it anyway, no matter where I'd been. But I always wanted to be in London, basically. I had a grandma who lived up here and I used to come up and she would take me to theatre and to galleries.
Did you ever, growing up, look to the future and see you having children?
So I did always imagine kids in the future. I sort of didn't really see myself. And I never saw a partner either, maybe weirdly. I just always imagined me sort of looking after this big gang of kids who I would always sort of describe as being like muddy and climbing trees. And I guess I assumed they would be mine, but that was never like explicitly the thing. I mean, I really loved like babysitting as a kid, and always just always enjoyed the company of babies and young children, and always sort of understood babies, like a kind of vibe of babies, I feel like. And in a way, I think being very introverted, I do find the company of babies and kids easier than adults. Although, weirdly, when I was very young, I used to love hanging out with the adults because I found kids my own age just sort of baffling. So, I had this image in my head, but I never considered how they'd be there, whether I'd have them or whether I'd be a mom or a dad, or nothing about that was clear to me.
Yeah.
Or particularly very interesting mm-hmm. to me. Yeah.
I guess as well, you went through a period of discovering yourself and transitioning. So was that then something that completely was back burner? Because you had, I want to say, bigger fish to fry.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's absolutely how it felt for a period. Like, so much has changed. I didn't come across the word transgender until I was at university, which was sort of the late noughties. I think possibly even 2009, when I was sort of in my final year at uni, which I'd really struggled through and almost dropped out. And so I was watching a lot of YouTube, being in my bedroom a lot of the time, and kind of came across this pirated documentary about a trans boy in the States. And it was a huge epiphany moment. Obviously, I'd heard the word transsexual before, only ever associated it with people that were, you know, mercilessly mocked and ridiculed. And so that could never be me. And also it would always be what I now know to be trans women.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I just, it is weird to think that, like, you never realised that you could be the other way around.
Yeah.
I think also, like, because obviously masculine little girls have a much easier time of it socially and they are praised for being tomboys mm-hmm. than, like, feminine little boys, right? So I could just be myself a lot of the time. And my parents were pretty accepting. And it was only at certain points where it caused tension and friction where, you know, with school uniform or I remember my auntie, who I love, asked me to be her bridesmaid and I had I thought it would be okay and then I just had a breakdown in the sort of changing rooms in Bluewater.
How old were you?
Oh, blimey. I was probably about 15, right. 14, 15. So I knew I'd never been comfortable being read as a girl, and when people used to mistake me for a boy, I'd sort of secretly love it, and because I knew there was something different about me. Yeah, it's very confusing as a kid to be in that situation. But yeah, it was just really came to a head that day in that changing room. I just remember sort of saying to my mum, I can't do this, I'm sorry. And I maybe even said, I don't know why. And she just said, don't worry, you know, you don't have to do that. And, and then we went to the wedding. My sister was a bridesmaid and then someone on the other side of the family was. And I think I sat in the car most of the time in my like jeans and T-shirt listening to my music, which I was probably really into by that point. So yeah, there were signs obviously throughout, and but it wasn't until university. And then I had this epiphany moment, thought this is it, and kind of felt like everyone's going to be as excited as me about this, because isn't this amazing that I found this answer? And then after about 2 weeks, I was in Scotland, so I couldn't just go home and talk about stuff. And but also after 2 weeks or so, I sort of realised, like maybe this is actually going to be more controversial than I originally was able to realise, because I was just on cloud nine, you know, thinking about stuff. And then also I got into this headspace of like, I was so used to being uncomfortable. I sort of felt like, not even sure I can do that. Am I allowed to do that? Do I deserve to do that? It took me a good few years.
I mean, that must have really played around with your mental health as well. You know, you talk about not fitting in and... But that's far deeper. Mm. That goes really deep, like I would imagine.
Yeah, I mean, it was really hard, but it's been your whole life. You just don't really know. I think that's what I struggled with, the idea that other people didn't struggle about these things in the way that I did. I always had just kind of assumed that other people must do. Otherwise, what is the answer? You can't not have an answer, right? It's kind of too scary. And also, you know, my mum would often reassure me that I would feel different eventually. And I wanted to believe her. So I was waiting for something to fall into place where, like all my other, my friends who were girls had really kind of grown into themselves and not had an easy time of it and like loved growing boobs or anything that's that kind of cliched, but sort of had really changed and felt like left me behind.
Right.
And I wasn't changing. It was getting worse, if anything, because I wasn't a kid anymore. So my non-conformity and difference were much harder to sort of bring into the adult world. I just felt like I was about 5 years behind everyone else, which I think is a really common queer experience, actually. But yeah, so it was, this sense of like, I could have that. I could go after that. And the only thing that matters is what I want.
Yeah.
Like that took a long time to get my head around. And the clinic, the gender clinic that I was referred to, I had to wait about 2 years for my first appointment, which sounds like a long time, but is now about a third of the time that people are waiting on average, because it's just gotten so much worse. But I think for me, that time was quite helpful, not necessarily actively helpful, because I don't want to let the NHS off the hook on this kind of front, because it's not good and it wasn't good back then. But it did just allow me to develop much firmer confidence and then clarity about what I was doing. And, you know, there was one point where I was, you know, on this road towards a potentially getting testosterone, which I was really excited about and a little bit nervous about, which I think is like totally healthy, you know, normal reaction to that thing. And then my auntie, whose wedding, funnily enough, I'd been asked to be a bridesmaid for a few years beforehand, she had another baby. So that made me suddenly worry and be like, maybe I should try and have a baby before I start my transition, because I'd been told that transition would make me infertile. And I really knew I wanted to be a parent. And I thought about that for probably a couple of days before realizing, no, that is not going to work. I can't do this. I need to look after myself first.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot look after another life or a baby without looking after myself
first. I'm sure I've read your words where you said, if I wanted to live, I had to carry on with that. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think it's such a huge thing that, like, that is the reality, actually.
Yeah, and I think it helped me to discover this language and to discover that there were options for me. But yeah, when I say, you know, if I wanted to live, if I wanted any kind of life, it's more that idea of, like, a proper life where I am happy and fulfilled and being myself rather than this sort of half life. Yeah. So it's not necessarily, because obviously people taking their own lives is a very big issue for LGBT communities, but it can also become a bit of a cliche and a bit of a thing, a bit of a kind of trope that we expect to hear from trans people.
Right.
That's not exactly my experience, but certainly in terms of, yeah, living a kind of healthy, happy, fulfilled life and being myself, like, absolutely, transition wasn't a choice. It was an absolute necessity. But yeah, it took me a while to accept that, I think.
Was your mum the first person that you told?
So the first person I actually told was one of my flatmates in Edinburgh, where I was at uni, called Karen. And she was great. And we're still very close.
Yeah. How did it feel actually saying the words out loud?
Oh, I think I probably felt really awkward. Like, what had felt amazing, before I spoke to Karen or anyone else, I had ordered a binder. Sort of secretly. And I remember that arriving. It probably came from America at that point because there was very few places that were doing it. And there was actually a company that had made, like, it was specialized in hernia compression tops and things like that. But they'd realized that there was a market also for trans men and compression vests and things. So I'd ordered that and it arrived and I felt nervous about it coming. And when all my flatmates were out of the house, there was lots of them, there was about five of us in the flat. I remember I put it on, went downstairs, stood in front of the big mirror with a t-shirt on, and I hadn't known what it would feel like, but it was such an affirming moment. I was like, sort of taken aback. I was just like, yes, that's me. Oh my God. Like, yeah, that was like my first clue, I suppose, that I was on the right path.
Yeah.
You know, at that point, I probably didn't even know where I would end up, but I knew from that day forward I would never not wear a binder again. And then at some point that would probably mean having quite major surgery, but I wasn't quite ready to think about that at that point. And then I went down the road to buy some tea bags that we didn't need just so that I could see what it felt like in the outside. And I just felt like I was walking on air, you know, very confident interacting with the shopkeeper even. It's hard to put into words, but like as everything about the trans experience is kind of hard to put into words sometimes. But probably like a month or so later that I had a visit home and talked to my mom, and she remembers it really vividly, and I do too, sitting on her bed in our old house. And, you know, I think I did a good job of building up in a way where I was like, this is going to be kind of big, but I need you not to freak out because I'm still liable to freak out. You know, this is new to me as well. And I sort of presented it as if like, I've come across this thing and I think it might be relevant. I wasn't like, this is me. And, you know, it wasn't like I could say, I am trans, and she would understand what that meant.
It's new language.
Exactly.
To you.
So, like, no one was talking about it. So, I started by explaining the concepts and hoping that she would be like, oh, yeah, well, that makes total sense because I've known you your whole life and this sounds like you. But she didn't say that. And I've heard other trans people talk about how it can be quite disappointing when you feel like you've discovered who you are and it will be obvious to everyone else and it's not. And maybe that's partly to do with, you know, the stigma of these ideas of being trans. But if she was worried, she didn't show it, which I really am grateful to this day. But I think at the end of the conversation, she just says something like, well, I just want you to be happy. And this is, you know, it's kind of big. But the only thing that worries me is the idea of surgery. And I think I probably said something like, well, you know, that's fair enough. But that's not something we have to worry about right now. And it wasn't. It didn't kind of happen for, I think, about 2 years from that point. Yeah. And then when it did happen, she came with me. Not only was she supportive of the idea and understanding at that point, but she traveled with me because I went to Florida because I wanted to visit this particular surgeon who was, you know, whose results I really, really thought were amazing. He was kind of the guy at the moment. Yeah, and she came with me and it was very supportive. I wouldn't have been able to do it without her. And then when we were there was another parent who was a bit newer to the idea of his son being trans. And so she was actually able to kind of be a bit of a mentor for him, for that dad from New York, I remember. And I think she found that really helpful because she kind of stepped up a bit into that role where she realized that now she was kind of a little bit of an expert and someone else needed help and she'd have needed that a few years before. So yeah, it was really beautiful actually to see that happen as well.
Yeah. Mm. One part of the documentary that had me weeping was literally your mum saying, I'm in awe of him.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I mean, it's so funny. It's funny in a way because, you know, we're still like very British and, you know, wouldn't say those things to each other in person.
But that's
so
why
it's
things
amazing.
Like documentaries and stuff are yeah. amazing because it makes people sit down and go, yeah. talk, you know, yeah. maybe a little gentle needling, you know, to get the words out.
Yeah. Well, funny enough, my mum is like a massive extrovert and
she
has much less trouble expressing her feelings. But yeah.
If anything, where's my I spoke for an hour. Why have I only got 2 minutes?
Yeah.
How did it feel when you first started taking tea, testosterone?
Before I started tea, I remember speaking to a consultant at the clinic and she helped me to sort of realise where I needed to get to in my mind in order to have confidence about this. And yeah. and I think I remember her saying something like, you know, because there's this huge pressure now more than ever really to, as a trans person, be like 100% sure. And the worst thing that could ever happen is that you might regret a decision.
Right.
And that this idea of detransition is held over trans people as like the nightmare scenario.
Yeah.
And in fact, actually, trans people and people who have detransitioned have often close, you know, intermingled, complicated relationships.
Mm-hmm.
But I was terrified about that idea for sure. So I remember someone saying to me, basically, you just need to do what's right for you now mm-hmm. in this moment. And don't worry about the future, like, 'cause you cannot know that. And that was hugely reassuring to me because I also did know at that point if it didn't feel like the right thing, you know, fairly quickly. Or even not that quickly, but, you know, over the next few months, I could stop. But, you know, right. it wouldn't be the end of the world. But then, yeah, I mean, you don't feel anything for a while. I remember doing a sort of vlog. I have, like, very embarrassing videos where I'm recording myself, yeah. which is kind of a cliche within the trans community. Trans guys have this joke of, like, it's like, this is my voice 2 weeks on tea. And it sounds exactly the same as it did 2 weeks ago. And then you just say that over and over again. So I've got those videos. No one's ever seeing them. Sorry.
One thing you've spoken about with mm-hmm. tea is that people have been informed in the past that it can make them infertile.
Mm.
That's not the case. I was stunned. I listened to you talking on another podcast where you said a lot of trans men fall pregnant by accident because you have there's silent ovulation that happens.
Yeah. So this, my experience, and I think it is complicated and different for lots of different people in terms of what they're told and what they're not told, because often it's a lack of information.
Yeah.
I remember being told explicitly that this is the end of the road in terms of having biological children. And it said it on the consent form that I was signing in order to be prescribed testosterone. And I think I just didn't really engage with that.
Really?
Because I knew I needed to start tea.
Yeah.
I just thought, I'm going to deal with that at some point in the future. And I probably thought, I'll just adopt. And, you know, I now know that that is a highly problematic, kind of meaningless statement, because adoption is its own thing
yeah.
that you need lots of motivation and commitment to do. But yeah, I I just knew I needed to start tea then, and also felt this pressure from a particular consultant at the clinic that I went to not make a big deal out of it. Because if I made a big deal out of it, then maybe I wasn't like really .. you know.
Okay.
Because like if you're a man, you're not supposed to care about kids, right? You're supposed to kind of act as though the idea of being pregnant will make you physically sick. Or
right.
So, and also I'd never seen a pregnant trans man at that point, so I didn't know that was physically, but that wasn't occurring. I wasn't thinking to myself, well, maybe I could transition and then have a baby. It was just like, this is it. So I don't know why I was told that. I don't know whether it's, yeah, like I say, kind of like a social thing of like, well, if you're going to be a man, quote unquote, then you shouldn't care about having kids. Or maybe you'll meet a beautiful woman one day and get married in this like very heteronormative way mm-hmm. that you're supposed to be trans. Because, you know, up until, I don't know, only maybe 10 years ago, if you were a gay trans man, then you wouldn't be taken seriously either. So,
right.
you know, forget about talking about pregnancy or kids. Like you have to be attracted to women in order to be a man. It's just like so confused and weird. And luckily that's not really a thing anymore. Lots of trans men are gay or
yeah.
bi, and we know that now, and that's fine. But yeah, I just was given the idea that, you know, yeah, you're trans and you can do this, but anything complicated you might be feeling, this isn't a safe space to discuss that. So, you know, go back to your trans friends and maybe talk about it there. But although there was nowhere I could talk about it there either, because again, trans men, I think we're almost like conditioned to even perform that stuff to each other in a way, especially then, not so much now, but then there were no trans men talking about like, oh, maybe I could have a baby. But yeah, there's no evidence that testosterone causes infertility.
Can you remember when you found out that that wasn't true?
Well, I remember the first time I saw a YouTube vlog, you know, good old YouTube again, from a American trans man called Caden, who's on Instagram, and you should follow him. He's gone on to have another baby since. He fell pregnant accidentally. He says it in his vlog. He was one of these people who, I don't know what he was told about the effects of testosterone on fertility, but he certainly assumed that because he wasn't having a period, that the testosterone was basically acting as a contraceptive.
Right.
I think nowadays you're much more likely to be told that testosterone is not a contraceptive, which is sort of moving in the right direction. But I don't think trans men are being given any kind of fully accurate or non-judgmental advice about their options for starting a family. But yeah, I mean, I know lots of people anecdotally who have fallen pregnant accidentally. I also know of a couple of cases that are sort of documented in medical literature where trans men went to emergency rooms not knowing they were pregnant. They weren't asked. And then, you know, this one particular case I remember reading about. Actually, it was a guy, he had done a pregnancy test that morning just to be sure. And then, so he did know he was pregnant and told the staff when he arrived at the emergency room. And if they had been trained properly, they would have picked up signs of preeclampsia.
Right.
He was late on in his pregnancy. Like, he'd gone the whole thing without realizing. But then, you know, as he was feeling ill, thought, oh, maybe I'll just do a pregnancy test. So anyway, long, terrible story short, he lost the baby. Because he was left for hours with high blood pressure and no one did a scan or checked or anything. So, yeah, that can happen and does happen. And the fact that that in itself isn't just a massive scandal kind of infuriates me on a daily basis. But, yeah, through Caden, I sort of was presented with this reality that he was pregnant. Like,
yeah.
Does that mean I can get pregnant? Was it because he wasn't on a high enough dose of testosterone? Or like, will my testosterone therapy eventually make me infertile? Like, all these questions I didn't have answers to. And actually, when I did conceive SJ, I still thought that it might eventually make me infertile. And that's kind of why I got pregnant when I did. Like,
right.
It was one of the factors anyway. I was in an okay position. Like, I had a good job and I had family support, but none of my friends were having babies at that point. But yeah, it was kind of, I felt like, well, maybe I can have a baby now, but maybe in future I won't be able to. And now I know that that's also not true. Basically, no one has ever researched this.
Mm-hmm.
So what we have is a complete absence of evidence of harm caused by testosterone
right.
to the ovaries or any part of the reproductive system for trans men. And then on the other side, we have hundreds of babies, increasing numbers of babies who are born happy and healthy, even if their birthing parent was on testosterone because perhaps they didn't know they were pregnant, you know, well into the pregnancy. If they stop, these babies are born like happy and bonny and whatever.
Yeah.
The advice is to not be on testosterone when you're pregnant, if you're planning to conceive, because testosterone is tetragenic, I think, which is like the medical term for harmful to a developing fetus.
Right.
But these trans men are having babies and they can stop their testosterone. So I guess I'm saying this to say that if you are in this situation right now, don't panic. Like,
yeah,
you'll be fine. But yeah, I did come off and sort of I was trying to conceive.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing.
Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Can you remember when you finally decided, I'm going to do this and I'm going to come off tea? I'm feeling like Jeannie. How did you feel? Can you remember, was there a big build-up to that actually becoming a reality?
Yeah, there was definitely... I watched that video by Caden and then I searched and found some more because it was just a suggested video. I kind of happened upon it.
Even that though.
I know.
You must feel like certain things just come into your life.
Well, I just feel more, again, I just feel angry that it was luck and relief. And like, oh my God, thank God. I just chanced upon that video and so many people don't, you know, and that just feels incredibly unfair and it shouldn't be that way. But yeah, I did. And then I learned some more. And again, I felt like, okay, maybe I could do this. And then with my job, I went to Australia for a year. And I think being really far away from my family, really struggling, feeling really homesick, or my other colleagues at the time sort of being in Australia with their families. So seeing that happen, seeing family life, and my sister had started having kids and I loved being an uncle. And yeah, it was that distance, like in a kind of cliched way, where I was like, okay, yeah, I have clarity. I have perspective right now. And I went to my boss, who is now my eldest godmother, and said to her, I'm really sorry, but I think I need to go home. I was like the only person making videos for Guardian Australia at that point. So it was kind of like, she was so sweet, very supportive. And she sort of joked about how much of a pain in the ass it was going to be for the company. But yeah, I think I sort of ended my contract about 2 months early and flew home. And my mum was really happy. Like, you know, and she'd always spoken about pregnancy in this like very positive way and almost in weirdly in a gender neutral way as well. Sort of, she says it in Seahorse actually about how like everyone should experience pregnancy. Mm-hmm. She had very good pregnancies. So I kind of knew that she'd be into it and what I was worried about was my friends and family would sort of think like, oh my God, really? Like after everything else, now this, you know, like it's going to come a point where we can't support you anymore or like you're just pushing it too far kind of thing. And there have been some people in my life that have sort of had that reaction or I've just grown distant from and I suspect feel that way. But my mum certainly was just like, fucking A, let's do it. So that was great. Yeah.
So in the documentary, you try first time. And that didn't work out.
Yeah, so I tried IUI. Yeah. At that point, I was planning to co-parent with my friend who's in the film, and yeah, it didn't work. But you know, it would have been unlikely to work. My understanding is I think most people who do intrauterine insemination with no medication, it sort of usually takes between like 3 and 6 attempts. I think.
Oh, really?
I think so. It's quite a low success rate. Like IVF has a higher success rate.
Well, IUI, you're literally placing it next to it, aren't you?
Yeah, you put the sperm in
next to the egg.
Via a catheter or something, I suppose it would be. And then you watch it on a screen and it goes squirts in. It's really funny. I had a positive experience at the fertility clinic, but yeah, I didn't take that first time. And then actually my friend and I realised that we'd kind of rushed into it because I had my plan for starting a family, which I'd been thinking about for a couple of years at that point. And my friend also wanted to have kids, but we kind of tried to mush our plans together in quite a rushed way. And it just wouldn't have worked. And we realized that kind of in the nick of time. So after that first attempt, I decided, you know, I was going to use a different donor and try again by myself. Because I'd always been kind of open to the idea of single parenthood anyway. Like, I'm not sure why, but I just always felt like that wasn't a scary idea. It was like, kind of feel like that might suit me. And anyway, again, I thought I was on the clock. I thought tea might make me infertile any day. So I needed to just do it.
Yeah. How did you find your donor?
I mean, it's a pretty bizarre experience. I think the weirdest thing about fertility treatment for me was that it was my first experience of private healthcare.
Right.
I was really aware of how much it felt like. I felt like a client. And because I sound like I do and present like I do, even though I was there to get pregnant, I was treated very respectfully. I think my male privilege was like firing on all cylinders, because I know other trans people who are maybe non-binary or trans women don't have positive experiences in those kinds of environments. It's a very, you know, it's a weird, uncomfortable thing to talk about, but that's, you know, I have to acknowledge that, yeah, I had a good experience. I think it's probably because, like, I'm a white university educated man. So, yeah, it was fine. And choosing a donor was, I didn't want to feel like I was like shopping or choosing particularly. Like, I really had a strong sense that I just wanted, you know, they're all screened, they're all healthy. It's quite a low success rate for being a donor. So I kind of just felt like I'm just going to trust that it's a good process and just pick someone who I get a good vibe off with the tiny amount of information you have. And it worked first time with that donor. Second donor that I chose, the IUI just worked. It was like, yeah, there's definitely...
So IUI again as well?
Yeah. With I think I maybe took Clomid, which is sort of a medication that you take for a few weeks afterwards. But otherwise it was unmedicated. And yeah, so there's... definitely nothing wrong with my fertility. It's like very fertile.
But going into that process, that's got to have been sort of hanging over your head in terms of fertility. How long will you have to be off T for to make that happen?
Yeah, that's why I felt like I was counting the days. What I really hated was not having T in my system. I felt like I really felt like there was something missing. It was running on empty. And how long am I going to have to be off T for? Not how long will it take me to conceive, but how long am I going to have to be off T for? And then, you know, when I found out I was pregnant, it was weird because it was like quite a mixed feeling. Of like,
really?
Yeah, just like, you know, definitely an element of like, wow, it worked. But also a big element of like, oh my God, I'm going to be pregnant for 9 months now. That's 9 months off testosterone at least, you know. Yeah, I was scared.
You did that test with your mum as well.
Yeah. And she's looking very glamorous in the film. She's very pleased that scene got left in, I think.
Was it first thing in the morning?
Oh, my God, it was about 6 a.m. Oh, because I think the clinic had told me to do a test that early. I'm not sure why.
You've spoken a lot about almost hiding your first pregnancy.
Mm. Yeah, I carried very small.
Right.
So I was able to just to kind of go around on a day-to-day basis. No one read me. No one sort of clocked me as pregnant. Even people I knew quite well, who I didn't, because I wasn't telling a lot of people.
And was that important to you as well at that time?
Yeah, I felt like if I'd been more visibly pregnant, I think I probably would have just stayed at home and been a bit housebound. Because even in Deal, I'd worried about the reactions it would get, not being safe. Kind of like people might react aggressively or violently or just might react negatively. And I couldn't take that. I was so fragile during that time. Yeah. And my parents have a kind of project in Spain where they're doing up this ancient house and it's very bare bones and quite not a comfortable place to be, especially if you're pregnant. But I went there as much as I could because it's in the middle of nowhere.
But it's, I think, just being allowed to be without the pressures of other people's expectations or...
That was like the bare minimum because it was also really hard to just be because of the lack of testosterone. And I was quite hard on myself, I think. I wasn't in a good place, but thank God. I connected with a friend of mine called Jacob, who was also pregnant at the same time, and he lives in the Midlands. That was so helpful. And then since then, so many more people have come out, you know, trans, non-binary, all sorts have come out as pregnant and shared their experiences. So I can't imagine ever feeling that alone again. And I feel a bit sad for me back then. You know, I just want to be like, oh, it's going to be okay. And things will change so quickly and you don't even know, kind of thing.
What is brilliant about the way that you share stuff is that you talk about having cis women trying to compare their experiences with yours. Mm-hmm. And there actually is a part of the film where you're surrounded by women and everyone's talking about mum, the woman, the birth. And we have moved on, I would like to think, in those few years since the film was made.
Mm.
But it's like alarm bells going off around you. Like, how do they not see what's going on? But it's fascinating, just that simple thing of you can't compare experiences because they are completely different.
Yeah. And it just triggers your dysphoria all over the place. But it's really hard because these people love you and they're trying to be supportive. And you can't reject that out of hand. You know, you can maybe like say something at another time, but
How did you feel going towards the birth? Did you have a plan at all?
Yeah. I did have a birth plan and I had a great community midwife the first time around who helped me write that. And I had also spoken to that boss I mentioned, to my SJ's godmother. I remember her sort of saying, I shouldn't talk to you about this, but she had a very traumatic birth experience, basically. And she did say, like, if you don't want me to talk about this, that's fine. But my approach to that kind of thing is like, no, I actually want to hear it. I want to hear how bad it can go. And her kids are fine and she's fine. And that happened a long time ago. So she did. She told me everything. And she told me, you know, make a birth plan, but do not think that that's what's going to happen.
Yeah.
I had another person locally who was a doula in training at the time. She came and drew a graph for me about what happens with the hormones at different points. So the fact that I could do all that sort of privately was really, and that was just a coffee. I didn't have to pay for that because I wouldn't have been able to afford it at the time. So I was very privileged, I suppose, to have those things.
Mm. I mean, hypnobirthing is such an amazing thing that I feel like we should all use in everyday life.
Yeah, I have definitely used that breathing when I got my tattoo the other day. Oh my God, I was doing it. Yeah.
How did you feel leaving home and heading towards the hospital?
I was kind of already in my trance state by that point because I'd been able to labour at home. So
right.
It's like, well, I had my first twinges at about 4 a.m.
Yeah.
And then Mum came over and it was quite a cold January day, quite dark. We kept the blinds closed and I basically just sat on a ball all day. And then about probably 2 p.m. we walked up to the beach. Where it's a stony beach where we are. And it's kind of a custom that you, if you're in labour, you go and walk on the beach because it will help things progress.
Because of the stones?
Because it's, yeah, you have the balance and you're
more.
Wobbling.
Yeah.
And you're kind of, it's quite strenuous, I suppose.
Right.
And yeah, then had a bath and then was like, yeah, I think I need to go in now. But my mum did that thing of like, maybe have another bath, you know. So like, it was just very relaxed. And,
yeah.
And actually then when we did go, it was terrible timing because then it was like rush hour locally. So there was a point in the car, I had my like playlist on and I had my eyes closed and I was breathing and I was just on another planet already at that point. But a part of me was vaguely aware that right. we were stuck in traffic. And that wasn't great. But then when we got to the hospital, I was already, I think, 6 centimetres dilated. So I hadn't realised how effective the breathing was. Mm. I was like, I was just doing it. They were like,
were
right.
You listening to different like scripts as well?
No, nothing like that. I was just counting.
Right.
No affirmations or anything, just counting. Just very like pragmatic. I'm going to do this. I was holding on to that like a life belt kind of thing. And I had like chilled music playing.
Yeah.
And then they ran the bath as quickly as they, or the pool when we arrived, like, trying to remain calm, but with a sense of like, yeah, you definitely need to like, oh, okay, yeah, very far along. And then SJ was born at about 2 hours after I arrived, I think. And it was great. I just had this like flannel on my back and Mum was at my, you know, cradling my head. And it was, I pushed a bit too hard too quickly because I think I was exhausted. And I think, funnily enough, this is like so specific to the trans experience, but I think because I'd been on T, I had very strong pelvic floor
right.
and abdominal muscles. And again, it's one of those things that no one can tell you because this isn't an experience that's talked about or known about, but I tore quite badly because of just how strong I was pushing and how
right.
hard I was pushing. So that's one thing I sort of felt was like, oh, maybe I should have just like been a bit more open to like coached pushing or something.
Right.
And then he was born.
And what was it like, that moment where yeah. you scooped him up, held him? Did it take a moment to kind
yeah.
of register? Because you're in such a trance,
yeah.
birthing, and then yeah. all of a sudden the baby's there.
Yeah, it was very dark and there was some cello music playing, which is so wanky, but that was absolutely
we'll go
perfect.
With it.
Yeah, yeah. And so like, yeah, so he SJ was born on call, you know, so he was in the sack. So actually...
oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. That's not obvious in the film.
No.
But yeah, so I remember the midwife sort of saying, I caught him, I think. And then the midwife was like, oh, just wait a second. Just hold him for a second. And I didn't know what was going on. And then I remember just kind of feeling, and I could feel this like slippery, obviously babies are slippery, but this
yeah.
felt like a whole thing, like a sort of, yeah, a big oval thing. But I was still just too out of it to really care, or you know, I just, as long as it didn't sound like anything was the matter, so I was just whatever. They were trying to get me to sit down, so I was more stable. And then I brought him out, maybe I don't know, a minute. It felt like ages, and I don't think I knew what had happened until a bit after that.
I've seen pictures, but I've never met anyone that's happened to.
Yeah, yeah, it's kind of amazing, given how much of a water baby he is, and that we live by the sea, and we've got like
yeah.
kind of maritime history in the family, you know, because it's meant to be good luck. Naval families consider it to be good luck if you're born in the call, or basically you're kind of nothing ever will happen to you at sea. I don't really believe in that kind of stuff, but it's nice story kind of associations and stuff. So yeah, and it does make me chuckle. In the film I say it's a boy and I'm like, God, it's not a good thing to say as a trans man. That's very bad gender politics. But I hadn't found out the sex, you know.
Yeah.
I think that's the first thing I said. And then I remember having some orange squash and that being like the best thing I'd ever tasted. But yeah, just holding this tiny little thing. He's so tiny. And I had donor milk, which I was a bit nervous about using.
Because you can chest feed, but obviously your surgery, that wasn't something that was spoken about at all.
It was not an option for me because of the type of surgery I had.
Right.
And amazingly, now I'm hearing that it is a conversation that some surgeons are having with their clients when it comes to top surgery, because it is totally possible. Basically, the standard way of having top surgery, you have double incision, which is basically a double mastectomy, and your nipples are removed completely and then placed back in a more kind of typically male position.
Right.
If you didn't remove your nipples, they'd be in the wrong place because they get rid of quite a lot of skin, basically. So that obviously ends the connection between your nipples and milk ducts.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, people don't know, maybe they'll reconnect, or because I have produced tiny amounts of milk when SJ was born, but then no extra milk when LB was born. So I don't think it's ever going to be possible for me. And that's okay. And I'm very grateful for being able to access donor milk through the Heart's Milk Bank primarily.
Well, can people just donate their milk?
Yeah, it's not, you know, you can't just rock up and hand it over. But Heart's is this incredible community-centric milk bank, whereas most milk banks in the UK operate either within hospitals or for neonatal units exclusively. Whereas in the US, it's much more common to have milk sharing and banks that are based in the community. I'm pretty sure I'm right in saying that Hearts is the first of its kind in the UK, where its focus is, I think it does also supply to neonatal units, but they will work with families directly in community in need of milk for whatever reason.
Yeah.
And I was lucky enough to hear about them through a local friend of mine who was a lactation consultant. And yeah, they helped us out. And then when LB came along a few years later, I went back to them. But I also had milk donated from individuals, which was so incredible.
How soon after birth could you go back on tea? And how did that feel?
That was great. I think it's different for everyone. I would imagine, especially if you do have any kind of postpartum mental health issues, you might want to wait longer, or they might be helped by going back on tea. Yeah. So it's always going to be a really individual conversation. I'm lucky to have a great endocrinologist, like hormone doctor, who I could speak to directly about it rather than having to go through my GP. So I think I went to see him about 8 weeks postpartum, and I didn't realize, actually, I thought he was going to give me a prescription that I'd have to take home, but he just offered to give me a shot of tea there and then, and I wasn't ready for that, and I started crying because that was just and I had a real kind of Hollywood moment of like, wow, we did it, like sort of coming full circle, because obviously baby's there, baby's healthy, that's the most important thing. But for me, giving birth didn't quite feel like the end of the process, you know, until I was feeling like myself again. You know, that's really when it felt like, yeah, like I did it and here we are and this is us and, you know, we're going to be a family, and it's so exciting. Yeah.
Yeah. And the film wasn't put out there until you were back on tea. Mm. I was reading recently.
Yeah.
You wanted to be back on tea and feeling more like you before that was out there.
That was a condition actually put out very early on, I think, before even agreeing, you know, saying that it was Jeannie that I wanted to work with. Yeah, I guess knowing myself, I just felt like, okay, I do want to tell this story, but, you know, like I said, I wanted to keep it very private while it was happening, because I sort of knew I was going to struggle and I didn't have a wider support system of other trans men going through it. So like when Jeannie would come to film in Deal, we would have cover stories for what we were doing, which was really funny. And because it's handy that I'm a journalist, right? Yeah. So like that was all very believable. But yes, it was, you know, it premiered at Tribeca in 2019, which I think is like in March. So it was over a year after SJ was born that the film was being put out there. So I was just very ready to share it with the world. And also, you know, it's a film. It's not actually what happened, which may sound funny because it is a documentary. But basically, when you film a documentary, you end up with hundreds of hours of footage. From that, you could tell one of hundreds of stories, really, like with a different angle or a different emphasis or a different tone. And, you know, it was for Jeannie really to go away and craft that. And actually, you know, so she was there when SJ was born. She came and said a very quick hello about 3 hours later. And then I didn't see her again for 3 months, I think, which was absolutely perfect and how I wanted it. So I didn't see the film for ages. I wasn't involved in the edit. And yeah, I was very happy with the story that she had chosen to tell about that time. But I felt like also it wasn't, you know, my experience and that film are two different things.
Yeah.
So I was able to retain quite a significant level of privacy, because so much happens in two, well, we were filming for 2 years, yeah, that, you know, there's plenty that isn't in the film.
Mm-hmm. Round two, going again.
Oh my God. Yes.
Yeah. But this time in a very different way.
Yeah.
You know, because you shared it. Is it because of the film and because of social media and because of feeling like you're part of a larger community now, you can share that with and feel solid with?
Yeah, all of that. You know, when I was trying to conceive for the second time, I wasn't the only person that I knew trying to conceive, certainly wasn't the only person I knew that had had a baby or wanted to have babies in future. It was just suddenly this conversation that was open to, like, oh, you know how we go on about how trans people are just the same as everyone else? Like, turns out it's actually true. And that includes wanting a family. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're a trans man, that you're going to give birth, but it might mean that. And that's totally fine. It's not a big deal, kind of thing. So, yeah, I just felt like I wanted to carry on. I wanted to be more open and share that second experience, because still aware that there's a huge dearth of information and advice out there. And I'm not a doctor and I would never want to give anyone medical advice, but I can just sort of say things and put things out there and make sure that people know to, like, ask that particular question, maybe, or maybe just not believe what they've been told a lot of the time. But yes, it was a completely different experience. It was good as well, but that I didn't take me long to conceive again. You know, it took longer, and there was the pandemic, which made everything more complicated. So there were delays and stuff, but I wasn't also struggling with, like, fertility issues, which I can imagine are incredibly difficult.
And how did the second pregnancy compare?
It was probably worse on the kind of nausea front.
Time you've got a toddler to run around after.
I know.
Well,
SJ was 3 by this point. So I had waited a while longer than maybe the average, because for a while I thought I would just actually have one. And actually that age gap, turned out to be kind of a godsend, because, I felt terrible for the whole 9 months of carrying LB, my second child. But at the same time, I was less nervous because it was my second pregnancy. So I was like, just give me the drugs to stop me feeling sick. Whereas the first time I felt like, oh, I don't want to risk taking anything in case, you know, it's a different mindset kind of thing.
This time around, though, you were planning on giving birth in Sweden.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I think this is around the time that I first started following you.
Right.
Because of the legal side of giving birth in the UK.
Mm.
So UK birth certificates, the person that gives birth is the mother.
Mm-hmm.
So that comes from a case in the 70s that was about deciding about inheritance or like inheriting a title. And that's actually the first time that it was defined in law, which is kind of funny that in the UK it always comes back to, like, who's going to be the lord or the lady. So, yes, it was. And then that also makes things difficult for surrogates.
Yeah.
It means surrogates have to be registered as the mother. And if they're married, their husband or partner goes down as the father, which just blows my mind. Because often, obviously, surrogates aren't genetically related and certainly don't want to be registered as the mother because they're not the mother, they're the surrogate. But that choice is taken away from them by this kind of paternalistic, outdated legal system. And for trans men as well, if we give birth, we are by definition the mother. And in the case that I bought to try to change that, I wanted to be listed as either the father or the parent.
Right.
Judgment was very surprising and kind of confused with respect to the judges, because on the one hand, it said that mother is no longer a gendered term, because now we have trans men that can give birth. So I guess they thought the simplest, quote unquote, solution to that was to say that mother isn't gendered. It's gender neutral, which is obviously ridiculous.
Yeah.
But then also, and in the same breath, they said that my legal gender recognition, which says that I am male for all purposes, isn't valid for parenthood. So it sort of stops at the point at which you become a parent. So the judgment said both those things, even though they contradict each other. So mother is gender neutral, but I'm also not a man when I become a parent. It just doesn't make any sense. And like, what I thought the court case was doing was presenting the courts and maybe government with an opportunity to update the law, because actually this system doesn't work for any non-traditional family, LGBTQ or blended or whatever. And then once we'd bought the case and it started, then the kind of transphobia nightmare began in the UK, and we ended up in 2019 with this bizarre judgment that said all these things that don't make any sense and don't really work for anyone, because, like, I don't think cis women want mother to be a gender neutral term either. But funnily enough, in our system, parent is gendered female, because only the female partner of a woman that gives birth can be registered as the parent. Basically, it was their way of getting round, of being able to put two women on a birth certificate.
Right.
So only the woman that gives birth can be recognised as a mother, and the other mother, because that's what she is, has to be registered as parent.
But Sweden, the law is different.
So in Sweden, a couple of years ago, a trans man challenged it in the same way that I did. Almost exactly at the same time, in fact. It's kind of this sliding doors moment where the Swedish government presented with this problem where someone who was legally a man and male for all purposes, and not just gender but sex, like that's what the law says, said, oh, hey, I can't register as the father. And then the Swedish government said, oh, thank you for pointing that out. Here we go. We're going to update the law. And it was just like that. It just happened.
Just that simple.
And same for trans women. And that doesn't mean that the child doesn't know who gave birth to them.
Yeah.
Because obviously the child's rights are the most important thing. That is the child's document. And often I get accused of sort of putting my own needs before my children's, which I'm obviously not doing because, you know, no parent would do that. But yeah, so the child can still know who gave birth to them, but they just have the sort of correct title, whether it's mother, father or parent. And lots of countries actually can allow for parents to go down as parent, whether they're trans or not. Like, it's just a kind of option.
Well, I mean, we're behind you.
Thank you. Yeah.
What was it like taking you back to LB and bringing LB home? Because did you think about beforehand what it would be like for SJ to have another little sibling in the house and how he might handle that?
Yeah.
Because any parent, you kind of go, oh, am I doing the right thing? Oh, bye.
Oh, yeah.
It's not just anymore.
Yeah, definitely. Especially as a single parent, right? Mm. Like, I was worried that he would suddenly be like, where did you go, basically? Even if I was right there, I might be distracted the whole time. And it really had just been the two of us for so long, even though we're always seeing friends and family. And actually, there's rarely a period of even a few days where we don't see people. And he goes to nursery as well, which has been amazing.
Yeah.
But yeah, so we talked about it, really. Like, that's kind of my approach, for better or for worse, is just to talk about everything. You know, if I was reading him books about how babies are made that are trans inclusive from the day he was born, almost, you know, and talking about his donor. And so, yeah, I sort of remember talking, you know, like, you know what it's going to be like, you know, there's going to be a baby and it's probably going to be really noisy and all sort of stuff, you know. I mean, I'm so grateful that there are so many books and programs now around about this kind of thing, right? So I wasn't having to figure that out by myself by any means. And yeah, I had all the same fears that I think most parents have about adding a sibling, of like, am I going to love them as much? Am I going to have enough love? You know, but actually, I was all geared up for it to be the year from hell in terms of sleep and stuff. But LB is very chill. And I don't want to sound too nauseating about this, but, you know, it's just like they are just an angel baby so far. And they slept through since about a month old, like, you know, 6 weeks old, and so smiley, and just love watching SJ. Just so curious about what they're doing and trying to get his attention the whole time and babbling away. Yeah, so, you know, and we sleep all in one big bed, which is easier for me. Yeah, easy for me to do and choose to do as a single dad. So,
yeah.
You know, there are ways in which, like, I actually think being by myself is easier.
Yeah.
Because I'm not having to factor in another adult. And yeah, like, I just made the decision, having struggled a little bit with SJ and bedtimes and sleeping, and then ended up, you know, co-sleeping with him. Just thinking, actually, yeah, I'm just going to do this because this is what works for us. And
that's the thing, isn't it? Because to some people, like, I can, like, early days with mine, people being like, oh, you're making a rod. What are you?
Yeah,
but actually, if it works for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
I still now, and mine are 8, 6 and 4, I'd sometimes climb into their bed until they've fallen asleep.
Absolutely.
I have a little nap.
I mean, it's the norm in many cultures around the world, and was here until like a few hundred years ago, I think.
Yeah. And you can understand that, though. Yeah. You can understand why to totally. Them it's such a nice, comforting thing. It's a nice bonding thing. You talked about the books that you read to the kids, or you read to the kids, but you've actually written your own.
Yeah.
Which is very, very exciting. I received my copy. It's called Little Seahorse and the Big Question.
Amazing. Cool.
And
what did your kids think? I have to ask you first.
They loved it.
Oh, good.
They loved it. And also, it's so colourful and everything as well.
All the illustrations.
And it's a conversation starter. Like, literally, you ask the question as you go through.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I should credit SJ the most, because I was saying so the other day. Like, I think people think it's going to be a book about seahorses having babies or, or like or transness in some way that's like appropriate for small kids. But no, it just so happens that the characters are like me and SJ. And so I thought, oh, I'll make them seahorses because, like, you know, male seahorses give birth and it's kind of a mascot for our community. But the conversation they have is nothing to do with transness.
No.
It's, yeah, it's just, it's a conversation that we actually had, you know, partly precipitated by me being sick of the idea that, you know, children need a mum and a dad. Mm. If they don't have that, they're missing something. But then, you know, yeah, I was
But even then, that isn't really said in the book. The question really is, what do we need? You know, if you could write a letter on parenthood, who would it be to and what would you say? I know, I like to get everyone really comfortable and like to throw a few, you know, big things at you at the end.
Yeah. Well, I guess, like, my first thought was, like I said earlier, like, I wish I could sort of go back in time and reassure me, like, 5 years ago that everything was going to be okay. But actually, I suppose building on that idea, I would write to a young trans person, trans boy or trans girl, doesn't really matter, or to young trans people in general, to reassure them that, I suppose, partly, like, you don't have to worry about this yet, because I think often in the media, fertility and future families are raised in a sort of scaremongering way to terrify the parents of trans children that they're never going to be grandparents and that they're doing something to their child that's going to make them infertile. We know increasingly that that's just not a concern in the way that it's framed. Sometimes it is a conversation that needs to be had, but there are always options, you know, and especially for trans boys, they do not need to be thinking about like harvesting their eggs at the age of 15 when it's like the last thing they want to do, because what you want to do when you're 15 is not going to be necessarily what you want to do when you're 25.
Mm-hmm. How does it make you feel knowing that when you were growing up, you didn't have people to look at, but now there are going to be young trans people who are looking at you? Do you know what I mean? And getting so much hope and validation in who they are and seeing a future, whereas, you know, maybe previously that wouldn't have been the case.
Yeah. I mean, the correct answer is that, like, it's amazing, but actually the real answer is that it's terrifying because, you know, like, me specifically, I guess I can't really comment on that, but obviously I'm very pleased and glad and relieved that there is a community and there are role models to look to. And yeah, obviously it feels amazing when I get a DM from a young trans person saying, oh, I saw your film, or like, oh my God, thank you so much for showing me that I can be a dad one day, or I can be a parent one day. Yeah, that's incredible. Again, I don't feel like I should be in that position. They shouldn't have to be looking to me. Do you know what I mean?
Like,
until the day when they are getting sex education at school in the same way that their straight cis peers do, I won't really be happy. I won't give you like a neat answer on that. But, you know, it's, I guess there's a lot there that wasn't. So, yeah, I definitely have to be happy for that.
Yeah. We finished the podcast on you completing three sentences.
Okay.
Being a dad means?
Everything.
Since having children, I?
Oh, God, that's like really grew up and became myself in some way. Yeah. Not as neat as the first answer.
It was a proper statement, the first answer.
Yeah,
nice
that
and
was
short.
Easy. Yeah.
And I'm happy when?
Oh, I'm happy when I'm sitting on the sofa with both kids. I mean, you know, I was happy yesterday when we were sat on the sofa watching Moana. SJ was consuming an entire bowl of popcorn to himself. LB was watching SJ eat the popcorn as if it was the most fascinating thing that had ever happened in the history of humanity. And I had a cup of tea. You know, yeah. That's my happy place.
Amazing. Freddie, thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, thank you for having me.